Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Father Daniel, nice to see you. I understand you recently went fishing and may have caught your first saltwater fish.
Yeah, I got to go saltwater fishing down, and that was with my community. We went, someone lent us their condo down in Key Largo and then took us out fishing, and I caught this big fish, and it was a permit. And then I got to go snorkeling as well, which I absolutely love. It's so cool to see the fish under the water, and got to see three sharks. Tiger sharks that were swimming close by, and I don't know if that was a stupid thing or not.
Yeah, but very cool, but, you know, tiger sharks, they're not messing around.
No, and these were not small ones either. They were like 6 or 7 feet long.
Let's open this show talking about the soul and the market.
Okay.
Critics once argued that capitalism bred poverty and squalor. Time has obviously confirmed that the opposite is true. In a new book called The Permanent Problem, author Brink Lindsay contends that capitalism has indeed solved the economic problem of scarcity, but has left what British economist John Maynard Keynes has called the permanent problem. That is, the challenge of living wisely and agreeably in the face of the vast resources that we have gotten from capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying that that has been left unresolved.
Well, I don't think it's the only thing that's unresolved.
One of the things.
I think there's also the transition when there's shifts in the economy, because people do lose their jobs, and there are also people who have unfortunate circumstances outside of their control. And then you have people who, because of their own life decisions, addictions, or laziness, that are in poverty. So those are unresolved problems in the context of capitalism as well.
So the way the direction the book goes is that capitalism, he's agreeing that capitalism is a machine exquisitely tuned to produce abundance, and in producing it, the machine that raises our expectations of what a human life could be. Mm-hmm. But the same forces that delivered abundance have steadily dissolved institutions in which flourishing actually happens, i.e. families, congregations, and neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
The whole dense undergrowth of face-to-face life that Alex de Tocqueville thought was America's secret. So Lindsay has, in his book, I think, essentially rediscovered by empirical induction what Catholic social teaching asserts by principle, that the human person is made for communion, not consumption.
Right.
So he suggests the antidote is to foster small independent communities that produce more of their own goods and whatnot. So
communes.
Yeah, which, you know, if that was what people chose to do, then they would do it, but they're not choosing to do that. At least sometimes they don't choose to do that. Sometimes they do.
Mm-hmm.
I think what the author really, I think he gets the question right, but I think his answer falls short in that the answer lies in having a rich spiritual life, and the communities that you're seeking is church.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Some community farm.
I think that's the hidden secret of success of capitalism in the United States that people are not talking about enough. You look at the history of the United States, what happened in our country? We started off with the ideal of the founding fathers of, you know, Republican setup of the government, the distribution of powers, of free trade. But early on, there was a religious awakening in the United States of America. Many of the founding fathers were more deists. They were not necessarily very devout Christians. But there was an early awakening of faith in the United States. And that coupled – so that capitalism, that Republican's form of government, coupled with religious awakening and Christian values, I think led to a flourishing of entrepreneurial endeavors and growth of the economy and growth of wealth that is unprecedented in the history of the world. Now, what's happening, though, I think, is as we lose our Christian values, we become a post-Christian society, a lot of those things that actually enable capitalism to take away some of its negative side and a mitigating factor is disappearing. And so you get in this raw drive for profit, which then denigrates the human dignity of individuals. You get the amassing of vast fortunes where people are, you know, we have our first trillionaire as of a couple weeks ago. And there's a vast fortune and then you've got people who are living in abject poverty, who don't have even clean drinking water. So there's this disparity that is growing because I think of the diminishing of Christianity and of the values that help us to recognize the responsibility of the wealthy to help the poor. So I think there's a whole other discussion that needs to be had at a societal level about the power that Christianity has to bring together the extremes. And as Christianity is diminished, the extremes are growing.
I don't think capitalism, though, is responsible for the destruction of the institution of, say, the family. I think it can be. If you work and you only work and you become a workaholic only because you're only concerned with dollars, then you're not going to be at home for your family. Okay, it can destroy your family. But I don't think capitalism structurally has been responsible for it.
No, not capitalism. But I think the drive for profit as the highest good could be a destructor of the family. I mean, think of it. You know, a husband who comes home and well, doesn't come home because he's working. Why is that? Because he thinks he needs to make more money. That drive for profit and money is destroying his family. So that's where I think the moderating or mitigating factor of Christianity is so important, because it helps us to realize that profit is not the highest good. It's important. It's an indicator of success. It's an indicator that things are going well. It's necessary for an organization to survive. But it's not the highest good. The highest good is something more than that. It's purpose. What's the purpose of a business? What's the purpose of the organization? What's the purpose of society? What's the purpose of government? These are the deeper conversations we need to be having as a society.
And you find that purpose in your religion and your congregation and your community that you go to church with and whatnot and you volunteer with. I don't necessarily think, I don't think you can, but I don't necessarily think that community farms is the answer. I think church is the answer.
I agree. But not all people do find their purpose in Christianity. And I think that's where it becomes starting to become a little bit more problematic. You know, how many times do we see people who are finding their purpose in, I don't know, in their dog or their cat? Or of some random cause that they ascribe to, which in the grand scheme of things is really not that important, but they're attributing value and importance to something that really doesn't have.
And if you find your purpose in your dog or your cat, that's not capitalism to blame.
No, it's not. It's misguided and not really thinking about reality. So we need the bigger picture, and our faith helps keep things in perspective.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crossed
Wires. The nature rights movement seeks to declare geological features, flora, and fauna to be rights-bearing things. Advocates often invoke mystical beliefs of indigenous peoples, such as the invocation of Pacamana, the Incan earth goddess. Some activists even claim that the earth itself is an entity and is alive. In that vein, the environmental journal PLOS Climate claims glaciers are more than reservoirs of ice. They are living beings within indigenous cosmologies, ancestral knowledge systems, and everyday life. For various indigenous communities, the author writes, glaciers are living ancestors, sacred beings, and integral parts of the relational world. The argument builds on rights of nature frameworks and notes that international actors such as UNESCO already designate glaciers as natural and cultural world heritage sites. So framing them as guardians of future generations and human survival is the next step, is what this author thinks. In response, the National Review states very bluntly that ice has no consciousness and it cannot reciprocate with people and has no agency. So I think I know what your response to this is going to be, and it's going to be along the lines of rights compared with responsibilities.
Always.
And glaciers have no responsibilities. Am I right?
Well, maybe they do. Maybe they're responsible for retaining clean, fresh water for us. I don't know. I'm just kind of thinking outside the box here. But it's a ridiculous argument. But you have to ask, I think there is a responsibility that we have as human beings to care for creation. I know Pope Francis talked about that and the Laudato Si, and I think that's a well-established principle of Catholic social teaching, an integral ecology. So we should be concerned for how is the conservation of our world going. But I think this undue pressure that we have to be God and we have to fix things, that's not a healthy way of looking at ecology.
Well, there's a facet that I want you to comment on that I was thinking about in reading this article. So consider that the Great Lakes were created by glaciers. Mm-hmm. And now some want to give the lakes rights as well. So in February 2019, the citizens of Toledo, Ohio, voted to grant legal rights to Lake Erie. It was after a toxic algae bloom.
Which responsibilities is Lake Erie going to take on?
So it was after a toxic algae bloom fueled by ag runoff left 500,000 people without drinking water for 3 days. Mm-hmm. A federal judge struck it down, calling it vague, aspirational, and a textbook example of what a municipal government cannot do. But he didn't tackle the substance of the matter, right? Mm-hmm. It was more a technicality. Now, I want you to consider this argument of nature rights from the perspective of, if those rights are now granted, it was the glaciers that carved the Great Lakes Basin 14,000 years ago, and the grinding out of the bedrock and depositing of the water that melted in their retreat back is where the lakes came from. So if you grant rights to both, you have a rights-bearing entity, i.e. the glacier, mm-hmm. that creates another rights-bearing entity, the lake, through an act of, you know, glacial scouring and melting.
What happens with human beings?
And
you have your children, and then you're rights-bearing, now
I think we might be going there. And, you know, if you were to do the same thing, if you were to create a lake, if a human did this, mm-hmm. then there would be lawsuits.
Well, definitely there'd be lawsuits because the lakes are bigger than what you can do from the Army Corps of Engineers.
Yeah, right. But it's just, this whole thing is just spiraling into madness, right?
It is.
Nature rights.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, and I think the argument ad absurdum is one of the clear ways that you can see that something is misguided from the beginning.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crossed
Wires. In Northern Ireland, a Sudanese asylum seeker was videoed attacking a Belfast man with a knife and blinding him in one eye during the stabbing attack. When the video spread online, rioters took to the streets torching vehicles and burning homes in some Belfast neighborhoods with large migrant populations. Almost exactly a year ago, Northern Ireland rioted after two Romanian teenagers were charged with the attempted rape of a schoolgirl. The year before that, riots swept across towns in England following a mass stabbing at a girl's dance class by a Muslim terrorist. The framing of the violence by the government and in the media has followed a predictable pattern, referring to the rioters as far-right protesters and racist thugs. The press and the government have avoided asking why working-class people across Britain and Ireland are at a boiling point. The UK has presided in recent years, over a large and lightly managed expansion of Muslim immigrants. As applications for asylum have surged, some contend vetting has been almost non-existent. And importantly, integration has been an afterthought. As the communities that bear the impacts of these policies react, they've been told that their discomfort reflects moral failure on their part rather than policy failure on the government's part. The government has gone even further, with their interior ministry, this is of the UK, having a research, information, and communications unit. The Daily Mail, a British tabloid, reports this division has been advising police on how to portray protesters and advising them to prevent statements that might inflame public anger over immigration failures. Further still, they claim that the unit intervenes to ghostwrite statements by victims' families to urge peaceful protesting, only and to remind the public of the vital role that immigrants play in their labor market. So, to recap, we have a legitimate public concern over policy outcomes, mm-hmm. crime rates, community cohesion, et cetera, strained services, being reframed as extremism, while family grief is shaped into generic calls for calm that emphasize migrant contributions. What do you say about this manipulation of the public discourse?
Well, obviously, anytime you're not living in the truth, it's always problematic. There's many different factors going on here, Chris. You know, on the one hand, you can never condone violence. So violence against immigrants, against any sector of society is never a good thing. But I think that there's a frustration that's manifested in that violence that needs to be looked at from a public policy standpoint and as a society. Because if you're suppressing the truth about what's happening with immigrant populations coming into an area not integrating, that there are things. I mean, in many Muslim cultures, they practice female genital mutilation, Prepubescent brides, practices which are not acceptable in Western societies and from a Christian viewpoint are very problematic. And you have these non-integrating members coming in into a society. It is a problem. And to not address that as a society, not talk about it, or to have that framed as far right or anti-human dignity, I mean, that's just not honest. So we need to have honest conversations about these things. We should be pushing against violence, but we need to have open conversations. And when people feel like they don't have a chance to speak or the truth can't come out, then they get frustrated.
I think that's exactly what's happening, that they're being told that they're not being considered in what these policy initiatives are doing to their neighborhoods, both good and bad.
Yeah.
And that anytime they speak out, they're called racist thugs, or they're called, you know, far right, you know, violent protesters, rather than, and I think that's what's causing this uprising of anger, because nobody's listening to us.
Right. Well, and not only that, they are listening, but they're silencing it, which is even stronger. So I was just reading yesterday a report that came out. There was a new report that came out from, I don't know the organization that put it out, in the UK, about 250,000 young white girls who have been sexually trafficked or profiled or chased or groomed by Muslim immigrants in the UK. I mean, this is a really, and the way that the police and the government have responded to it is by poo-pooing it, by silencing it. Even in one case, they brought a girl back who had been trafficked and brought her back to the people who had raped her and said, have fun with her. I mean, this is mind-blowing. And this is why people are up in arms, and they're starting to act out, because their government is silencing the conversation about what's really happening. That's problematic.
Yeah, and from the church's standpoint, immigration is not a problem per se to be managed, right? That immigration itself is not problematic. We obviously all agree, I think most all of us would agree, that lawful immigration with some consideration for the impacts to the communities that you're encouraging folks to set up shop in, and a intent for these folks to assimilate, mm-hmm. right? That's all.
I think that's proper. The key element is assimilation and integration, and doing it in a lawful manner. But another factor that comes into play, and the Holy Father just spoke about recently about this, is that there is a right to emigrate, to go to another country, to find a livelihood for your family, for yourself, etc., which the church recognizes. But he said that first and foremost, there's a right to stay in your own country. And I think that's what's not oftentimes taken into consideration, much of the political discourse that we're hearing in our own country. We hear a lot about, you're so hard-hearted if you're not accepting these immigrants. But what's led to the situations in their home countries that is so problematic from an economic or political stability or safety standpoint that they feel like their only recourse is to flee their home country? And this is where, as Americans, we can't turn a blind eye to what's going on in the world. We have to have a heart also of compassion for countries with failed states or economic systems which don't allow for the development of the people, education that's failed in different countries. And I think this is an important part of our Catholic view of the world, is to say, how can we create the conditions for people to be able to stay in their home country if they want to? Because I think most people would prefer to stay where they speak the language, where they have family close to them, where they feel like they're in their home. But unfortunately, the circumstances, because of failed states and poor economic practices
and corruption,
it does force people to move. And so there is a right to immigration, but there's also a right to stay in your place of origin.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crossed
Wires. Longtime CBS News correspondent and 60 Minutes mainstay Scott Pelley was fired by the network after he publicly accused CBS leadership of destroying the show and combatively disrupted the introduction meeting of the show's newly appointed executive producer. His departure is another in a growing list of mainstays, leaving what is arguably the most prestigious news program in American history. Would you say that that's the case? 60 Minutes,
60 Minutes, yeah. Yeah, it's one of the longest running.
Yeah. So predictably, the mainstream media reaction to this has been largely sympathetic to Pelley, framing the story as a cautionary tale about press freedom. The National Review thinks this episode explains the mindset of the news media and why it is responsible for the massive credibility gap that exists in the public's view of the media. Mm-hmm. The thinking is this: the news business thinks of their profession as something akin to a public university with a tenure track instead of a business that's focused on profit through broad appeal. News people have become accustomed to a version of the news industry that operates with a mindset where revenues are unconnected to performance, where a captive audience is a given, where viewpoint conformity is ruthlessly enforced, where loyalty is rewarded with lifetime employment, and where criticism of is worthy of attention only if it comes from within the institution, not from without. So for roughly 2 to 3 decades, from the 1960s to the 1980s, the major broadcast networks essentially ran their news programs as prestige loss leaders. Mm-hmm. They weren't intending for them to make money. Mm-hmm. The news divisions lost money or broke even, subsidized by profits from the entertainment program that they had. So before the publicly traded media conglomerate era, many newspapers were owned by families such as the Sulzbergers with the New York Times and the Grahams with the Washington Post, who treated them more as civic trusts rather than business. So
sure.
First, do you agree with this analogy from the National Review of the industry being akin to, the news industry being akin to, treated like a university system? What do you think about that?
Well, I think it goes back to a critique of the university system itself. The problem, I think, is ideology. And how do I define ideology? Ideology is taking one aspect of reality and blowing it out of proportion as a whole system, which then ignores other parts of reality. So what happens is you start ignoring the truth. You stop listening to reality. I think what's happened in our university system and also in our media system is that they have taken an ideological viewpoint and then they ignore certain parts of reality. There's a really interesting book that was written by a CBS insider many years ago about media bias. And he pointed out the difference in voting trends between people who work in the media. And this was back in the late 80s or early 90s, he wrote this book. And he pointed out the discrepancy between voting patterns of those who work in media companies and the voting patterns of the general public. I'm not saying of Republicans or Democrats, but of the general public. I mean, it was so, like, skewed. It was mind-boggling.
Even back then.
I mean, I'm talking back early 90s. I think that's only been exacerbated in recent years. So I think this is the underlying problem. When as a society we stop looking at the truth and we stop looking at reality and we've latched onto an ideology.
All right. So the news used to be able to be a prestige loss leader because you had no other choices. There were 4 channels.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And now folks have a marketplace of so many other choices. So so you can't,
monopolize it in the same way.
Yeah. So what about this idea, though, that the news and these newspapers that are owned by families should be treated as a civic trust instead of for profit?
I don't think they should be treated as a civic trust. I think that they have a special responsibility. And their special responsibility is to unearth the truth, to seek out reality.
And why would that be their responsibility? And why would that also jive with the business model? Because the truth is attractive.
Yes.
The truth has broad appeal.
It does. But it's also interesting because I think the monetary question when it comes to the media is an important one, because money talks. And people, they're going to spend money on things that are true or that are responding to reality. So when they've isolated themselves in ideology, and the bottom line is going to bite eventually because they're not aligning. And I think this is the growth of a lot of alternative media, because they're trying to tell the truth in a lot of the alternative media sources. Do they do it as well? Do they have the same resources? No. And sometimes it's a little shoddier, not as polished. I mean, even our show, to a certain extent, crossed wires. I mean, we got
extremely unpolished.
A $0 budget, not polished at all. But, it's catching on with some people. So this is, I think, a reality we got to look at.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires. On a per capita basis, Canadians today are more likely to die of assisted suicide than Americans are to die of gun violence.
Canada's, are you serious?
Yes.
Oh, that's an interesting stat.
Canada's assisted suicide laws started with strict criteria in the year 2016 and then loosened substantially in 2021 to apply to anyone considered not just to be nearing death through some incurable disease, but also those who suffer gravely, whether or not they were close to the grave.
Mm-hmm.
There's no greater champion of assisted suicide than Canadian doctor James McLean. The Toronto Globe and Mail and the National Post are both reporting two of McLean's assisted suicide cases in 2024 have come under scrutiny following public complaints. In one, Dr. McLean thought it appropriate for a man to be put down because he had Crohn's disease, which is not deadly. He thought so because the man did not have an active social network, had difficulty maintaining a job, found personal relationships difficult, and was dependent on his family for housing and financial support. So McLean did an assisted suicide for this gentleman. Hmm. In the other case, McLean tried and failed to kill a 67-year-old cancer patient who had previously consented to assisted suicide. The doc was called in when the man lost consciousness. Dr. McLean administered the death meds but didn't realize the kit he was using lacked the neuromuscular blocking agent that he would need to finish the job. He pronounces the patient dead after being unable to hear a heartbeat. But because basically he had only been sedated and not killed, the doc was called back in because the patient started breathing again.
Hmm.
The guy, he thought he was dead, and he had been declared dead, and he administers this time a second kit and successfully kills the patient. And now he's under, you know, or he was under some investigation by the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario. He gets reprimanded and placed on supervision. But ultimately, he's allowed to continue practicing and continuing to provide assisted suicide. Isn't this crazy?
Yes.
And, you know, part of it is single-payer healthcare. I think part of what's going on in Canada is you have rationing of healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And you have folks that it's easier to just medically assist them into suicide rather than deal with their problems because they have so many people waiting for the necessary services that mm-hmm. they can't get.
Right.
You know, what are your comments about single-payer healthcare in regards to medically assisted suicide? I mean, hasn't that always been predicted that that's what would happen?
It clearly has, but I think it's a deeper problem. It's a view of human life that suffering is the greatest evil. I think that's the underlying problem. And actually, the Holy Father talks about this in the new encyclical letter Magnifica Humanitas about AI and the culture, you know, transhumanism and all that. But suffering is not the greatest evil. Separation from God is.
Amen.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crosswires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens. On AM 1160, The Quest.